Welcome to Securing America with me, Frank Gaffney, the program that's a kind of owner's manual for protecting the country we love against all enemies, foreign and domestic, to the glory of God and his kingdom. Yesterday, we did at the Committee on the Present Danger China a very important webinar, part of an ongoing series on unrestricted warfare that the Chinese Communist Party has been waging against our country. The keynoter of that program, very important contributor to it, I'm pleased to say, is our first guest, a regular here at Securing America, something I'm also extremely proud of. His name is Gordon Chang. He is, for my money, the best China analyst and commentator in our country. He can be found, among other places, at Gordon G. Chang on Twitter. His books include the really important work, The Coming Collapse of China. And you can also follow his writings in a number of important publications, including Newsweek and the National Interest and the Epoch Times, which just happens to have published this week a very, very powerful interview with Gordon about China preparing for war against our country. Gordon, it is great to have you with us. Thank you again for your contributions to yesterday's program. We'll talk more about it in a moment, but I'm very, very pleased to have a chance to visit with you and get an update on China's preparations to go to war against the United States, the old-fashioned way, not the unrestricted warfare, but the kinetic kind. Welcome back to Securing America, my friend.
Thank you so much, Frank.
So, Gordon, I think what you've been doing, which is incalculably important, is you've been not only looking as comprehensively as we can at the evidence of what the Chinese are up to, but also synthesizing it and analyzing it as evidence of a coming war. Give us the most important of those tells, as you see them, and why the conclusion is now pretty much indisputable.
We all focus, of course, on China's military buildup because it is the fastest since the Second World War. But what is even more disturbing is the internal mobilization of China's people. And this was signaled on the first day of last year with changes to the National Defense Law, which removed powers from the State Council, which is civilian. That's the Chinese central government, and sent them over to the Communist Party's Central Military Commission, which is responsible for the People's Liberation Army. And these powers related to the mobilization of the civilian population. Now, since then, there have been a number of signs where it shows that China really is trying to get its civilian society ready for war. Let me just mention a couple of them. Last month, I had a conversation with a Chinese entrepreneur, a factory owner, who was making medical products for the civilian sector. And he told me that he was visited by Communist Party cadres and told that he had to change his production lines, no longer making civilian products, but to make products for the military, items for war. And this was not just an isolated incident, because he told me that a number of other private factory owners also had similar visits. And he said something which I hadn't really focused on. And he said that the Communist Party was actually operating now factories that were once owned by private parties, because those private parties knew what was coming and they didn't want to stick around for Xi Jinping's war. That just shows you, these incidents just show you the breadth of China's mobilization of all of society for battle.
And I guess this is really just a central theme of what we've been facing from China for some time and may now be confronting in a new and much more dangerous form. And that is that everything's kind of a whole of society approach. The advantage of a totalitarian system is it can basically compel everyone to participate in whatever its agenda may be, and especially if that's external aggression. That's a very serious problem of the size of China, especially. And Gordon, when you look at the mobilization, another indicator, as we've discussed in the past, but I think it's always important to harken back to it, was this video out of Guangdong Province. Remind us what it professed was up in that very important part of China.
Yeah, this video from Guangdong, which is the southern part, the province that surrounds Hong Kong, which is really the factory floor for China. There is a video of supposedly a secret Communist Party meeting where the cadres were talking about war in a very short time frame. You know, people have disputed the veracity of that video, but it is consistent, Frank, with a lot of other indications that we have, not only from Guangdong, but around China as well. So I tend to believe that that video actually is real.
Yeah. A second opinion was given to us on this program by Steve Mosher, a member of our Committee on the Present Danger China, who says, you know, it quacks like a duck, walks like a duck, and so on. And he's pretty convinced that it is the authentic thing. And Gordon, the point of it was that it recorded these party cadre and military officials responding to guidance from Beijing, which presumably was given to all of the other provinces as well. And if so, it suggests, again, this whole of society nationwide mobilization for the war that's coming. And I think also, Gordon, you know, the kinds of hardships and sacrifice and imposed discipline that this so-called zero COVID policy has entailed is probably another indicator of what the party intends to do to make sure that everybody bends to its will. If told to go prepare for war, they will do that, no?
Yes, you know, with the zero COVID policy, which is essentially a policy to prevent any transmission of the disease, so it's draconian lockdowns, very frequent testing, so many other measures. You know, Chinese officials know it doesn't make sense from a disease point of view. And so people have speculated that really this zero COVID is an attempt to control the Chinese population. And there's, you know, we don't know the intention of Xi Jinping, the Chinese ruler, what's exactly inside his head, but clearly he does have population control in mind because his measures are consistent with that view. Right now, China is just under lockdown. You know, there are a number of cities which, you know, there's no problem at all, but all of a sudden the disease pops up. And now we're talking Chengdu, 21 million people under lockdown, Frank. This is surprising.
Unimaginable. No.
Shenzhen, you were talking about Guangdong province. Shenzhen is under localized lockdown. But this disease, Omicron, it just is highly transmissible. Communist Party should know that this zero COVID no longer makes sense. And the reason they keep it, you know, one reasonable inference is that this has now become population control more than anything else.
Yeah. Well, the China model. And fortunately, they've been exporting it as part of this pandemic response, thanks in no small measure to the World Health Organization promoting it. Gordon, let me turn to the topic of yesterday's webinar. You essentially inspired it with an important piece that you wrote at Gatestone Institute, as I recall, last week, namely that the Chinese Communist Party is trying to mobilize overseas Chinese, including, of course, Chinese Americans, for the war effort when it comes. We described it as a kind of fifth column, hearkening back to, you know, a term that was used in the Spanish Civil War for sort of an insurrection being mounted from within the enemy population. Give us a sense of that problem. Well, actually, let me just ask you to, when we come back from a short break, which we have to take momentarily, to give us a sense of not only the likelihood that China will be able to compel, coerce, or otherwise induce this kind of help from Chinese populations overseas, but in particular, what it might mean for us. We'll be right back with that and more with Gordon Chang right after this. This is Frank Gaffney with the Secure Freedom Minute. President Biden's Independence Hall speech last night amounted to incitement to violence against millions of supporters of Donald Trump's efforts to make America great again. Biden effectively launched an officially sponsored color revolution, complete with an ominously lit Marxist red backdrop and military personnel literally in the shadows behind him. His rhetorical othering of MAGA Republicans, combined with the imagery, conveyed the unmistakable message that our armed forces will be weaponized against the threat they pose to democracy, as he has already done with the FBI, the Justice and Homeland Security Departments, and IRS. Biden is right on two scores, quote, too much of what is happening in our country today is not normal, unquote, and that it's a time for choosing. He is, however, greatly compounding what is wrong, namely his presidency and policies, and intent on foreclosing Americans' ability to choose an alternative. This is Frank Gaffney. We're back, and the great Gordon Chang is in the house virtually. We're talking with him about the distinct possibility, in fact, I think the likelihood of war of the old-fashioned kind, the kinetic kind, with communist China. And Gordon, just before we broke, I teased the prospect that a feature of this war, if Xi Jinping has his way, will be help that the Chinese Communist Party might command and receive from overseas Chinese populations, including a very large one in our own country. We did a webinar on this, in which you featured prominently. It's available now as a video from presentdangerchina.org. I would like very much to encourage our audience to take a look at it, because it's an important new facet in this unrestricted warfare space. But tell us, Gordon, your assessment of the likelihood that significant numbers of Chinese expats would respond to this kind of call, and what that might mean for our internal security.
Xi Jinping gave a landmark speech to the Communist Party's United Front Work Department conference, which was held in Beijing in the last couple of days of July. During this speech, he called upon cadres to mobilize ethnic Chinese around the world in support of Communist Party policies. Now, the United Front Work Department, that's their goal anyway, in general, and Xi Jinping's predecessors have made similar calls, but this one was of grave concern. We got to remember that Mao Zedong, the first leader of the People's Republic, actually tried to use ethnic Chinese around the world to overthrow their home governments. And we know that Xi Jinping reveres Mao, he's adopted Mao's tactics, and indeed has adopted Mao's goals. So we have to be extremely worried that this is something that he is now putting even more attention to than in the past. This was not some perfunctory call to the United Front Work Department. This was a landmark speech. And therefore, we've got to be worried that we have ethnic Chinese around the world who are motivated by these calls to blood nationalism, which is really what it is, because Beijing does not believe that any ethnic Chinese should be loyal to their home country, to the country of their citizenship, that they must be loyal to the Communist Party.
Yeah. And you made the argument very powerfully, Gordon, that those who are in our country and who benefit from our freedoms have a duty instead to be, you know, embracing and supporting our national interests and security. And yet there are instruments available to the Chinese, apart from, you know, the propaganda, notably, but not exclusively, of course, on Chinese language broadcasting in our country, that are moving beyond simply indoctrinating Chinese overseas to conform to the party's dictates, but they also have a practice of using coercive techniques on people's families back home to induce them to cooperate, whether it's collecting intelligence or perhaps more subversive activities. And this is what makes, I think, this seminar so important, is really your call for, you know, Americans not to be bludgeoned into ignoring this danger by the Chinese, you know, claim that we're all a bunch of racists. I think one of your most important points, frankly, was the racism of the Chinese government itself. You might just make mention of that, if you would.
Yeah. The Communist Party has this, what's called Han nationalism, and this is a racist view of the world, that the Chinese and the Chinese alone have the mandate of heaven to rule what they call Tianxia, or all under heaven. And this is not just
the whole world.
And this is essentially not just some sort of fluff from the imperial era, because Xi Jinping has been emphasizing these Tianxia themes, especially recently. And we know that Chinese in the United States have responded to it. There have been these prosecutions and guilty pleas of ethnic Chinese who have committed espionage on the part for China. And we also know, and this is a story not so much of what China's trying to do, but it's also a story of the United States knowing that Chinese diplomats and Ministry of State security agents operate freely in our country to coerce and surveil Chinese nationals and those of ethnic blood. So this is something that runs throughout the United States, and we don't do anything about it. And by the way, Frank, you know, before the pandemic, you could see all these flags of the People's Republic of China flying in Chinatowns, especially in San Francisco. That is especially suggestive of disloyalty to the United States. So
you've made the point that with the pandemic, that the visibility of that association was diminished somewhat in the flag flying, right?
Only because of the pandemic. It wasn't taken down because people in San Francisco had a change of heart. The Communist Party is still active in that city and many others. So really, this was just sort of a protective measure that they thought, well, because of the pandemic, Chinese were being targeted, so we're not going to fly the Chinese flag. But that was not a change of heart. The most important thing is, what do Chinese think? And many of them think that they can work for the People's Republic of China. And that is, of course, wrong.
Yeah. Gordon, very quickly, and I don't think we talked about this yesterday, but I'd be interested in your thoughts about it. Of course, one other component of this Chinese-American community, or at least Chinese nationals' presence in our country, is, by some estimates, over 300,000 students in the United States, all of whom are here with the permission of the Chinese Communist Party, obviously, and quite a number of them seem to be, you know, children of party members or other favored individuals. What about that as a threat vector in this regard?
Yeah, pre-pandemic, there was something on the order of 380, maybe 390,000 Chinese nationals on our campuses, college and university. And as you point out, most of them were favored by the regime one way or another. There were estimates that 13% of those students were engaged in activities which were inconsistent with their presence on campus as students. In other words, they were committing espionage. But we know that the Ministry of State Security and Chinese diplomats surveil them, especially through the Chinese Students and Scholar Associations, which has units on all the campuses where there are significant portions of Chinese students, which means, you know, most everywhere. These CISA units actually are run out of some of the Chinese consulates. And that's really an indication that we have allowed this to occur on our soil. You know, this is our country, Frank. We don't have to put up with this, but we have. And this is a matter of first priority that we stop this activity, because it is inconsistent with our sovereignty.
And our security, indeed. And of course, there's no reciprocity on that scale with Americans in China, let alone that they would be doing espionage collection for us. Gordon, lastly, very quickly, just a reminder of the horrors of this regime in China and what it does to its own people, which I think is a very important indicator of what they would do to us if they were able to, in fact, take us down and colonize or otherwise dominate us. psychiatric hospitals being weaponized against dissidents or others in China? Quickly on that.
Yeah, since the early 1960s, the regime has been using psychiatric hospitals to house dissidents. They're strapped down to beds, given electroshock treatments, pumped full of drugs. They lie in their own excrement. China supposedly stopped this in 2012 and 2013 with the adoption of a mental health law and changes to the criminal procedure law. But this has continued, as evidenced in a report by Safeguard Defenders, a Madrid-based NGO, which has looked at instances of this occurring from 2015 to last year. Obviously, China has continued this horrific practice.
Yeah, and it is just evidence of more generally their horrific practices towards their own people. Gordon Chang, we have to leave it at that. Much more to talk with you about. We'll look forward to doing so next week. Next up, we'll speak with Cleo Pascal about another inroad the Chinese are making in the South Pacific, Solomon Islands, and more right after this.
Black-garbed assailants clash with police in the streets, smash windows, and throw Molotov cocktails in an effort to destroy police stations, federal courthouses, and local businesses, all in the name of anti-fascism. Most Americans are now, sadly, all too aware of the movement known as Antifa. But where did they come from? What do they want? And how do we stop their campaign of violent mayhem? The Center for Security Policy Press is proud to present Unmasking Antifa, Five Perspectives on a Growing Threat. This new book looks at the history, ideology, organization, finances, and strategy of Antifa and provides an in-depth analysis for law enforcement officers, policymakers, and the general public. From street fighting tactics of the Black Bloc to fundraising by prominent left-wing foundations, Unmasking Antifa is the go-to guide to understand this elusive and dangerous threat. Get your copy of Unmasking Antifa, Five Perspectives on a Growing Threat at Amazon.com.
Back. And when we are going to talk about a part of the world that requires urgent attention, there's really only one person that we can turn to who really covers it and covers it extremely competently and assiduously. I'm talking about the islands of the South Pacific, and I'm talking about Cleo Pascal. She is a senior fellow with the Foundation for Defense of Democracies. She is a regular contributor to the Sunday Guardian of India. But she's a specialist in this part of the world and is one of our go-to resources when, as we must, we need clarity about what is going on, in particular, in the Solomon Islands at the moment. Cleo, it's great to have you back. Welcome once again to Securing America.
Thank you very much. That was a very generous and kind introduction, and it's always a pleasure to be on your show. Thank you.
Heartfelt and actually well-deserved. But let me ask you about this. In the recent days, since we last spoke, we had what seemed to be a fairly direct affront to the United States. I don't think we were the only country that was affronted, but It was pointedly the case that an American Coast Guard vessel that had previously, as I understand it, arranged to make a port call in the Solomon Islands in the aftermath of the 80th anniversary of the Battle of Guadalcanal, which was a decisive victory for the United States in World War II. The ship was not given permission to dock. Apparently, it wasn't exactly told it couldn't, but it wasn't told it could. And so the captain took it elsewhere. But Give us the context in which this was happening and its significance, as you see it, Cleo.
So it is highly, highly significant. The cutter was with ships from other countries as well, and they were on an illegal fisheries patrol. So you can't get more common goods than a Coast Guard vessel looking for illegal fishing boats. And to not let it come into your waters and indeed say thank you very much is a huge statement. And especially, as you say, this is coming very shortly after the commemoration of the beginning of the Battle of Guadalcanal, which raged for 6 months and was horrible and brutal and killed so many Americans and others. And the Prime Minister of the Solomon Islands, Prime Minister Sogavare, did not attend those services at all. And he's in the process now of trying to postpone elections. Elections are due in 2023. He's put forward a bill that is probably going to be debated and voted on this coming week to put them off. And we know that that's likely to trigger dissent. And he's prepared for that with a lot of Chinese police trainers and Chinese equipment, including drones and vehicles and who knows what else.
And a presence of Chinese in Papua, in the Solomon Islands, rather. And what he is doing, it seems, is very much realigning his country with the People's Republic of China, the Chinese Communist Party, and dissing and otherwise treating with some contempt, even, the United States. The response to this cutter incident has been a lot of hand-wringing and breastbeating, it seems, in Washington. Have we seen anything done in the way of a practical response to date?
So not on the surface. I don't know what's going on underneath the surface. There's been a willingness in public to accept his excuse, which was it was a bureaucratic snafu and, you know, they just need to put their protocols in order and we'll get back to you once we've done that. What he's actually done is block all foreign vessels, all foreign military vessels from Solomon Islands waters. And now the trick will be to keep a very close eye to see what Chinese ships, if any, he lets in the interim. But this is a sort of metastasization of the Chinese way of running a country. He's cracking down on his media. He's cutting it off from the rest of the world. He's trying to get rid of that pesky little thing called democracy. He's going after his opposition. And it's all being done in broad daylight, relatively close to the shores of Australia. And so if he gets away with it, there'll be similar proto-Mugabes all over the Pacific saying, oh, you know what, I'd like to gain control of my country and its resources and have a private Chinese military to keep me in power as well. It's an extremely dangerous precedent. Vanuatu is on this trend. Kiribati is on this trend. And Kiribati comes, you know, relatively in Pacific terms, not far from Hawaii. So this is, if this ball starts to roll and democracy and rule of law and accountability and transparency isn't protected, you could start to have an effective Chinese island hopping campaign that bypasses the first and second island chain and starts to create some real problems for U.S. positioning in the Pacific.
Yeah. You have sort of talked about the problem that the Chinese are clearly taking advantage of this situation, if not essentially calling the shots, that this fellow who seems to have had his palms greased by the Chinese, certainly he has greased the palms of others in the parliament to secure this outcome, and that he doesn't want any foreign vessels in his waters, let alone in his ports, if he engages, as the Chinese, I think, would help him do in a crackdown, a violent crackdown of such protesters as you might see to his postponement of the elections and otherwise his, effective termination of democracy in the Solomon Islands. Is that in fact, as you see it, the agenda? And would you be surprised if despite this edict, there are indeed Chinese vessels that wind up porting in the Solomon Islands in the midst of this prospective crackdown.
So this is a country that did sign a security deal with China that allows for things like if the Solomon Islands government, which is Sogavari, you know, he doesn't represent his people. So let's just call it the kind of China Sogavari deal. It allows for him to allow the Chinese, for the PLA to come in to do things such as promote civil order and protect Chinese citizens and protect Chinese major industries. So he can do something like give over a tract of virgin forest forcibly to the Chinese and then say, bring in your own army to protect your investment and give me some money off the side. That's all kind of legal as per this agreement. It's not legal as per proper operation in the Solomon Islands. But if you've bought off 39 of the 50 MPs and there's no punishment coming from Australia, for example, where a lot of the money, the Chinese money goes into to pay off the MPs, and those MPs might be buying property in Australia with it. And the Australians are just letting it happen. They're not cracking down on corruption. They're not saying if you're found guilty of corruption, you won't get a visa to Australia or New Zealand ever again. So we really need those Five Eyes partners to step up. And if they won't do it, then perhaps the U.S. should.
Well, let me come right back to that. But just very quickly, as I understand it, when there was popular resistance to this president of the Solomon Islands a few months back, the Australians actually sent ships in to try to help establish once again his control of the situation. So not only have they not been, you know, playing for the good guys, they've been actually helping this very problematic character. Which brings us to this question of so what should the United States be doing, Cleo? What would your recommendation be at a moment like this, given, as you say, the very considerable strategic stakes, not just for, you know, the people of the Solomon Islands, obviously, but also for our own interests in that important region?
So there needs to be an understanding that the Pacific Islands are back in play, like they were in the 30s. This is extremely dangerous time. And the US is under attack. It's a political warfare attack. You know that very, very well. But it is just as effective if they can block your ships from ports, from key strategic locations, places where, you know, young men died, their blood is soaked into that beach and you can't land a illegal fisheries Coast Guard vessel. I mean, it's outrageous. So this really needs to change. And we need to understand that, you know, that the interests of Australia and New Zealand may align, but they may not be the same. And there's no substitute for getting directly involved. So the embassies that have been announced that would be open, they're supposed to, the U.S. has announced that it will open a new embassy in Solomons. It needs to do so. Currently, it's being covered from Papua New Guinea. There isn't even an ambassador in post in Papua New Guinea. So all of those positions need to be filled. They need to be staffed. The situation needs to be taken seriously and not just focus on the Solomons. The zone that's actually most vulnerable for the U.S. is the freely associated states, Palau, Marshall Islands, Federated States of Micronesia. Those are countries that have unique security and defense arrangements with the United States, and they are under similar political warfare attack, and they need to be defended.
And if they watch playing out, as you've described it, the unraveling of, you know, what has been to this point a pro-U.S. entity in the region going to the Chinese, I have the feeling that a lot of others may be tempted to make separate pieces with the Chinese and profit from doing so personally. Cleo Pascal, nobody does this region better than you do. Thank you for keeping an eye on it and for reporting back to us on it from time to time. We look forward to a visit with you very soon, especially in terms of these steps that the United States really must take to make sure that we are not compounding the dangers that are arising there now. Next up, we're going to speak with George Raceley. We'll talk a bit about the president's speech in Philadelphia, what it means for you, and more right after this. This is Frank Gaffney with the Secure Freedom Minute. President Biden's Independence Hall speech last night amounted to incitement to violence against millions of supporters of Donald Trump's efforts to make America great again. Biden effectively launched an officially sponsored color revolution, complete with an ominously lit Marxist red backdrop and military personnel literally in the shadows behind him. His rhetorical othering of MAGA Republicans, combined with the imagery, conveyed the unmistakable message that our armed forces will be weaponized against the threat they pose to democracy, as he has already done with the FBI, the Justice and Homeland Security Departments, and IRS. Biden is right on two scores, quote, too much of what is happening in our country today is not normal, unquote, and that it's a time for choosing. He is, however, greatly compounding what is wrong, namely his presidency and policies, and intent on foreclosing Americans' ability to choose an alternative. This is Frank Gaffney.
We're back, and we're going to talk now about Joe Biden's recent very acerbic, very, I believe, provocative comments about millions, well, probably tens of millions of Americans who support and who would like to see a restoration of Donald Trump's policies to make America great again, so-called MAGA Republicans, according to President Biden. A man who has spent much of his professional life working in politics, some 300 different campaigns have benefited from his assistance and counsel, including most of the recent presidential ones, is our next guest. His name is George Raceley. He is a regular contributor, I'm proud to say, to this program, and one of the smartest guys I know, period. Mensa certified genius at that. Always important to point that out. But George has been following closely from his perch as the editor-in-chief of the terrific newsletter that Richard Viguerie puts out called Conservative HQ. And I wanted to pick his brains about what Joe Biden is up to at the moment. Obviously, working in the political arena to benefit Democrats in the upcoming election. But is there more to it than that? And George, I wanted to first say welcome back to Securing America.
Thank you, Frank.
And get your thoughts on what Joe Biden is up to.
Well, Biden's speech was easily the most outrageous public commentary of any president in the history of the United States.
Well, now this is the speech at Independence Hall last night.
Yeah, I mean, unbelievable, divisive, antagonistic. I contrast that to what the political rhetoric was right before the Civil War, and he sounded exactly like the Confederates, who, by the way, were all Democrats. Whereas, you know, you had Lincoln calling people who disagreed with him his brothers and his neighbors, and telling them that there could be no division unless they made it. And Biden said virtually the opposite of everything that Lincoln said in those very distressed times in our history. And my takeaway personally was to make sure I voted and to make sure that I bought more guns and ammunition because somebody was coming for me.
Huh. George, the phenomenon of othering, which I know you're very familiar with, seems to be at work here. It's not just that he was sort of ascribing, wrongthink to MAGA Republicans. He was really vilifying them as people who were set on destroying our democracy. And I think of it as a constitutional republic rather than democracy, but endlessly we hear that the threat is to democracy. And he described it as a very violent threat at that. Would this, in fact, qualify, do you think, as an incitement to violence against the other, in this case?
Oh, absolutely. I mean, Biden was giving, the Antifa Democrats and BLM and the various other shock troops of their militant arm permission to go after Republicans and conservatives and Donald Trump supporters. And, you know, they immediately took the cue.
Even violently, I think it's fair to say.
Vandalizing Republican headquarters. And, I look for more of that. And we saw the same thing after the leak of the Roe v. Wade Supreme Court opinion. Democrats gave their military arm the go-ahead to go out and attack Republicans and conservatives and pro-lifers. And they did. And that is the model.
Even Supreme Court justices were pretty much made fair game in the process,
absolutely,
were they not? So, George, again, this is a term that not everybody in our audience may be familiar with, but I know you are. I was struck by the stage setting for this event, the blood red sort of Marxist coloration of the backdrop, the two Marine sentries, if you will, in silhouette or in shadow, at least. The overtone seemed to me to be kind of an officially sanctioned color revolution being put in motion.
Absolutely.
Is that too much of a stretch?
No, not at all. In fact, you and I and various others of our acquaintance have discussed all of the tells, if you will, that such a color revolution is underway. In this case, it's not being conducted against a communist enemy like the old Soviet Union, but it's being conducted against our own country. And
by communists, I would argue.
By communists. Yeah. But one of my specialties in presidential politics was nonverbal communication. The stage setting, the backdrop, who you include in the camera shot, what all is going on around the event. And Biden's nonverbal communication was probably as important or more important than what he said, which was, and the nonverbal communication was clearly, the military and the full armed force of the United States is arrayed against citizens whose only crime is to vote for the other guy.
Yeah. And it sounds as though that is going to be criminalized, in fact, as well as, as you say, the military, among other arms of the government, being weaponized against them.
Yeah.
George, we're going to talk a bit more about this on the other side of a very short break. Mm-hmm. We're going to also get into where's the Republican leadership in responding to all of this. That and more with George Raisley of Conservative HQ right after this. Welcome back. George Raisley is in the house from Conservative HQ, Richard Viguerie's terrific newsletter, which he edits. George is a very experienced and accomplished politico, a man who has served on numerous campaigns and was just describing, I think, a particular specialty of his as it bears on President Biden's recent speech in Philadelphia. The nonverbal communications and what they were signaling to his supporters, and most especially, George, as you say, the militant arm of the Democratic Party these days, whether it's Black Lives Matter or Antifa or other Marxist operations. This begs the question, George, if essentially Joe Biden is invoking a kind of revolutionary action, including violence, against these Republicans, where are the rest of the Republicans? Are they in the tall grass? Are they cheering him on? Are they simply intimidated? And what are the prospects if they persist in that behavior that this may have implications for the Republican Party writ large?
Well, Frank, they're being in the tall grass. I'd say that they're huddled around the bar at their country clubs and avoiding, if at all possible, getting in this very existential fight for the future of our constitutional republic. And I wish I could explain why, other than personal antipathy for Trump, and perhaps some of them, maybe even a significant portion of them, essentially being on the other side. Not that they necessarily want a communist or socialist takeover of the United States, but they don't want to fight for individual liberty and the constitutional principles that guys like you and I work for every day.
And, you know, I guess this is the kind of aspiration that Biden is really calling out when he talks about a threat to our democracy. It really seems to me to be exactly the opposite. We're trying to preserve that constitutional republic and all that it stands for, notably our freedoms, absolutely, which are a threat. So, George, you have written about a friend of ours and a very highly regarded pollster, John McLaughlin, mm-hmm, who has recently been warning Republicans that they risk blowing the opportunity to have a very, very profound course correction, a sweep electorally, and therefore a mandate for making the sorts of changes to what the Biden administration has been doing that are so urgently needed, clearly. Talk us through what is on the line and what those Republican leaders in particular need to be doing now instead.
Well, yeah, Frank. I mean, John has done some very, very excellent polling, which your viewers can see on his website, McLaughlin and Associates. But I mean, the bottom line, the short version is that to the extent that the much ballyhooed red wave may be fading a little bit, it's because the Republican leadership aren't in the fight. What they're essentially counseling their opponents, or rather their candidates, to do is to sort of play a prevent defense, a rope-a-dope campaign, and assume that they're going to glide into office on Biden's unpopularity. And so you don't see the Republican leaders or their sanctioned candidates out there talking about Biden's many policy failures, why we are in a recession, why America is in retreat around the world, why our southern border has ceased to exist. And Newt Gingrich said, you know, to make the red wave real, you need to make every Democrat's first name Biden. And you don't see Republicans other than the MAGA candidates out there doing that, because the so-called leaders of the party have said, well, you know, just lean back on the ropes and you'll skate through with 51% of the vote.
On the theory that you're just not as bad as the other guy.
Exactly.
That doesn't necessarily give people a reason to vote for you. And especially if they may have a feeling about how bad the other guy is, but may not sense that there's really an alternative to them.
Well, yeah.
You may not see that that vote coming your way, let alone a mandate for real leadership, which is so urgently needed. George, I couldn't agree more with you and John McLaughlin on this point, and pray that we will find people who, among other things, will be talking about China and the threat that it poses to us at a moment when I fear whoever is elected is likely to have to confront a war with the Chinese Communist Party in the not-too-distant future. And I did want to just close by saluting you for a piece that you've written, informed, I know, by family experience, liberating, in the case of your father, islands in the Western Pacific in the course of World War II. We've talked earlier in the week with Cleo Pascal about the Solomon Islands and here on the 80th anniversary of the start of one of the greatest battles of all time, the Guadalcanal. We're watching the Chinese inexorably taking over, it seems, that incredibly important island chain. Just a minute, quick thoughts on all of that, George.
Well, the Red Chinese are simply following the same path that the Imperial Japanese did. They intend to encircle the South China Sea and Southeast Asia with a ring of influence and perhaps military occupation. And the Solomon Islands are key to that. And they are right now, in essence, robbing us of that hard-fought, won-in-blood victory by influence and potentially by establishing a military base there.
We mustn't let that happen. George, we have to leave it at that. Thank you for your time. Thank you for your expertise. Thank you for all you do at Conservative HQ and more. Thanks to the rest of you for joining us for this edition of Securing America. I hope you feel better equipped to help us in doing just that, and that you will henceforth go forth and multiply.